The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, folks, we're going to start our third panel now, the first of two this afternoon, after that very interesting and stimulating speech on freedom of information and secrecy by soon-to-be Chief Judge Lamberth. I wanted to mention just at the outset, in case there'd been any doubt, this is St. Patrick's Day, of course, and I had pressed to see if we could possibly have not only corned beef but also green-tinted beer for lunch. That turned out not to be possible only because this is the first day back after spring break. Had it been any other time of the year, it might have worked out just fine, but we did at least have that green key lime pie in recognition of that day as well as Freedom of Information Day and Sunshine Week. We try to commemorate all the holidays we possibly can here at the Washington College of Law. Now, this panel has a somewhat unusual title. It may be unfamiliar to some of you, pseudo-secrecy. And what pseudo-secrecy refers to is the growing practice, especially in the last 7 years, almost 7 years since 9/11, of federal agencies using safeguarding labels to safeguard information, which is to say to protect it within their four walls, which is not to be confused with whether that information actually would be disclosed outside of the agency in the face of a FOIA request or some other access demand. Those are two offshoots of the word secrecy. Safeguarding is not necessarily the same as non-disclosure. A lot of overlap, to be sure, but not necessarily the same. With respect to national security secrecy and classification under the prevailing executive order, yes, they are one and the same. Classified information is both safeguarded and it is protected from disclosure under Exemption 1 of the FOIA. But unclassified information, which might be sensitive, is often safeguarded, according to as many as, I think the highest number I've ever seen estimated is 111 different safeguarding labels, such as SHSI, SHSI, I pronounce it that way, Sensitive Homeland Security Information, SBU, most commonly used, Sensitive but Unclassified Information. There's also CUI, controlled unclassified information, that might become the designation of the future. And then there's the good old-fashioned, old favorite, especially at the Department of Defense, FOUO, for official use only, or FUO, sometimes pronounced that way just as we pronounce it, FOIA. There has been a presidential directive that mandates the rationalization of this whole area, and that directive was issued in December of 2005. And as a matter of fact, on December 16th of 2005, the president said that there had to be recommendations made for improving this realm of things within 1 year. Well, it's now St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 2008, and that hasn't taken place yet, which has made this issue one of a growing concern with the passage of time. Our three speakers today are very well positioned to speak with respect to this. First, most senior in the middle, is William Leary.
Means oldest.
No. Tom Sussman told me earlier that senior doesn't mean oldest. It means legendary in some respects. Yes, we've had a redefinition of that today. Is Bill Leary, that sounds younger than William, doesn't it? Yes. Who, as your bio shows, and I'm not going to take precious time to repeat what's in the bio, is a senior director at the National Security Council and also holds at least one presidential appointment with respect to the ICE cap, I think. And let me put it this way. 5 weeks after 9/11, when the concept of sensitive homeland security information was conceived, SHSI for short, which has been codified in law, by the way, in the Homeland Security Act, there were only two people in the room, and Bill was one of them, and I can tell you firsthand that that is so.
You were the other one.
Okay. I didn't want to say that. And then Shizzy became SBU in time, and now me evolved to CUI. Bill has been very active in this area for a long time. Will Kammer, closest to me, is the chief FOIA officer, FOIA policy office head at the Department of Defense. And every time I say the word FUO or F-O-U-O, Bill winces because he knows firsthand how that sometimes can get in the way of proper FOIA processing. That people at DOD see something stamped FUO and they think that necessarily means it's exempt, where it ain't necessarily so. And speaking of being a little bit critical, there's also Sean Moulton on the other side of the panel, not merely on the other side of the fence, so to speak, who is perhaps the leading expert in this subject matter area for all public interest groups at OMB Watch. And Sean is someone who's very, very much aware of the fact that agencies have been using this proliferation of safeguarding labels and that it's been a problem. A lot of misconception has followed from it, and that it's now a big question as to whether the administration finally will be issuing something this year to help rationalize this process. So with that brief introduction, let me take a seat on the other end there and just throw out a general question to our panel as to how things have been in this area and where they see things going. Is that a good way to start things off? Maybe start with how things have been in this area in the past.
I'll start. I think it's fair to say they have been confused and incoherent. And this is certainly been accentuated by 9/11 and the heightened anxiety and angst created by 9/11. But the incoherence goes back many decades, I think it's fair to say. Sensitive but unclassified information for official use only information has been handled in a bewildering variety of ways, has been defined in a bewildering variety of ways, and has been handled in a bewildering variety of ways for decades, which is why, one reason why, many of us, including myself, including I think Dan, were extremely reluctant to wade into this briar patch in the first place. And I think the history of the last 7 years, post 9/11, when, as Dan suggested, there has been a highest possible level push to develop systematic, coherent guidance, regulations for handling sensitive but unclassified information. Not only the presidential directive that Dan mentioned in December 2005, but that was preceded by an executive order in July of 2003, which ordered the Department of Homeland Security and the the Attorney General and to come up with something like controlled unclassified information, systematic guidance for agencies to use in identifying, marking, safeguarding, and protecting sensitive information that is not classified. The fact that it still hasn't happened, and according to the information I received from the person most responsible for this within the last week, I don't know when it's going to happen.
Or if?
Does not mean, I think, that people haven't been trying to figure it out. A lot of people have been trying very hard to figure it out. And I think it's an effort worth continuing to pursue. But it is exceedingly difficult, to say the least, to come up with a single systematic set of guidelines, requirements, explore how all agencies should handle all different types of sensitive but unclassified information. There is an inexorable tendency to come up with something that is so vague and imprecise as to be virtually whatever any user chooses to make it. So that's where we stand, I think.
Well, we'll have a, from your perspective, struggling with the interface between FUO and FOIA.
And I know, Dan, you almost slipped and called it FUI again. But
yes. I have upon occasion called it FUI. You're absolutely right.
Let me echo Bill's comment. It's confusing. But one constant that I think that we will see is that from the Freedom of Information Act standpoint, if CUI is formally passed, it will not make any difference from the Freedom of Information Act end of things how the documents are processed. You can stamp whatever you want on the document as a marking device. But as Dan, you were talking about, one of the challenges that we have, and this will be, I think, the main challenge in bringing about a CUI program, is the education of the people who are actually going to be making the decisions as to what is going to be CUI. The education of these folks as to what properly should be marked CUI or SPU or FOUO or whatever you want to call it. And so the education is going to be key. Right now, I think one of the things that we've seen that falls right into this and very important is the protection of PII, personal identifying information, which is a category of the type of information that CUI would cover.
Wait, CUI would subsume PII?
It would not subsume it. PII would be a part of CUI, which is three-letter acronyms back to back. Right.
Okay.
Or TLAs, as they are referred to as.
At DOD.
Yes, that's the three-letter acronym.
Everyone knows what TLA stands for, right? Three-letter acronym?
As opposed to an FLA.
Which is what? Anyone know what an FLA? It's a five-letter acronym. This is the federal government we're talking about. We skip four and go right to five. Sorry, go ahead. Is my mic on? I often give feedback, but I try not to do it inadvertently, so thank you very much.
But I think the protection of personal identifying information in documents that are not classified is one of the primary things that we need to worry about, and I think that a proper designation of CUI on this type of information or FOU or whatever the designation is going to be, I think and the education process that will go along with it, I think will go a long way in helping us identify this personal information that is on these documents. That, to me, is going to be one of the main benefits of this emphasis and this importance of CUI. Otherwise, confusing, absolutely. There's been a lot of involvement since 9/11 on the protection of information that is unclassified but yet determined to be sensitive for a number of reasons, statutory and otherwise. But the evolvement of that has led to one of the exemptions, the B2 high exemption in the FOIA, being the exemption of choice in using it as perhaps a way to withhold information that prior to 9/11 had not been identified as something that would be of sensitive nature and that we wanted to withhold. So the involvement of the B2 high exemption, I think, has been one of the big parts of what is going to be CUI and the education of CUI. And as Dan, as you said at the beginning, simply marking something, a document, in and of itself, sometimes, unfortunately, leads the originator of the document to assume that the document has armor on it and cannot be touched. And a new program with emphasis on it, such as CUI, will present education challenges to us to once again say, no, that is not true. And particularly in the Freedom of Information Act, obviously we all know that even the designation of a FOIA exemption to protect information does not mean that document can't be appealed or litigated. So that'll be all part of the education challenge that I think is going to be a challenging thing for us to do, but at the same time, I think can have a lot of benefits.
Another way of phrasing the education challenge is to talk about the fact that currently, as things stand, there is enormous room for misperception. And that misperception, I think, exists in two places. One within the agency, when either the document stamper believes that that creates, armors it, so to speak, makes it exempt, or where the FOIA officer looks at a stamped document and thinks, ah, this must fall within an exemption because it's been stamped SBU or something like that. Then there's also misperception outside of the agency when reporters, members of public interest groups, see agencies stamping documents more and more, and you can't really blame them. They're inclined to think, well, that equals secrecy. That means those records now are being withheld, as if there's been a broadening of FOIA exemptions, which only Congress can do. They don't realize that that's not necessarily part of secrecy. It's potential secrecy, but only when a FOIA request is made will you know whether a stamped document is exempt and will be withheld as secret or not. And I'm going to imagine, Sean, that from your standpoint, looking at it from the outside, you're concerned about that, both misperceptions. And you're probably also concerned about the fact, not to be too argumentative here, that Will is speaking about CUI as if that is the regime that's about to take place, and there have been reports even in OMB Watch indicating that, yet it ain't necessarily so. There might not be anything done even by the end of this administration, even though the directive goes back first to 2003 and then to December of 2005. What do you think of that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're concerned about those issues. I mean, I think to talk about where we are and where we're heading, from OMB Watch's perspective, and I think from a lot of the general public and public interest community, if the panel members here who are inside the government find the process confusing, that word is an understatement from the outside perspective. It is confusing, it is frustrating, it is difficult, and quite honestly, too often we feel frozen out of the process. We feel we have issues, we have concerns, and yet there is not really an effort from the government perspective to really address those concerns. What really happened here, while Bill was reluctant to kind of go out into this briar patch, and I think that's a good analogy for what we've stumbled into, I think unfortunately a lot of other agencies weren't. They were more than willing to kind of charge out into the briar patch, not realizing the problem they were going to get themselves into, not just from a public disclosure point of view, certainly our biggest concern, but from their own information management approach. And what happened is you had sort of a prime example of bureaucracy run amok. The agencies were in charge of creating their own new categories, of creating procedures for implementing those categories. There wasn't really an effort to talk to each other, to talk to state agencies, talk to local agencies. It was all well-intentioned, and we acknowledge that, and most everyone acknowledges that the idea here was, after 9/11, was to try and get a handle on sensitive information, but it clearly spun out of control very early on.
Are you talking about after the executive order in 2003, or more recently after the issuance of the presidential directive in December of 2005?
I'm talking about earlier on.
Immediately
after 9/11, when literally you had this kind of explosion of alphabet soup out there, whole new categories were created.
They
were
card,
the card memorandum, exactly.
Where you and I remember that, yes. That's what proliferated SBU.
And you had agencies out there setting up critical energy infrastructure information at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and there was a. There was a pattern to these new categories. They were always vague. They were always broad. There was very little definition, very little scope in terms of restrictions placed on them. There wasn't much in the way of a checks and balances kind of procedure set up that once information got stamped this whatever acronym, whether it's official use only, there was almost no way really in the procedures to get that stamp removed. And so it created a great deal of confusion. Now, where we're heading with this controlled, unclassified information is probably in some ways, from what we do know of it, a step forward. But it's a step forward more administratively than anything else. It's a step forward in trying to get control of the bureaucracy itself, try and simplify it and make it a little bit more manageable internally. Our big concern is, as I said before, there hasn't been much of an acknowledgement or an incorporation of the public disclosure and the public concerns about this information while developing this policy. And I think that has been a real oversight so far, and one that is going to have to be addressed at some point. I don't know whether the policy is going to come out in the next month or the next 6 months or before this administration leaves. But when it does, it's really going to be the first opportunity for public interest groups such as OMB Watch and others gathered here today to then weigh in and say, this is where this piece is missing, this is not being incorporated. And in my opinion, that's too late. It really should have been done earlier on before the policy gets established, because my concern is once we get a policy, it's going to be a long time before we amend that policy. There's going to be this consideration of let's see how it works before they start addressing concerns that the public interest community has.
Sean, something you said reminded me, and I'm sure it will remind Bill as well, of that. The fact that when SHSE evolved to SBU in 2002, there were public statements made by OMB, I believe it was in August of 2002, mm-hmm. that no uncertain terms promised the public in general and public interest groups in particular that they would be involved in the process. And as a matter of fact, I remember there was testimony in October of that year on the part of a high-level government official, not a high official, but a high-level official, so presumably that was well understood exactly what he was saying, reiterating that same thing. Yet we find ourselves today without any commitment whatsoever toward that, where you have to worry about the fact that something could be rolled out tomorrow, next week, or next month without any such input at all.
Although in theory, that consultation could still take place.
Ah, good.
It was never envisioned that the consultation, I think, would take place before the government interagency process had figured out what we thought our policy ought to be. Having then figured out what we thought it ought to be, I think my assumption when those statements were made back in 2002 was that then there would be some sort of fairly formal consultation with interested parties outside the government to get their reaction. I hope still that is what would happen. I have no reason to believe it will or it won't, frankly, right now, because I've been involved in the last year or so. But I think it.
So the very fact.
As constructed now, what I know about controlled and classified information, the scope of this is breathtaking. It covers any and all information created or acquired by the federal government that any designated official thinks should be safeguarded and protected. And as Sean suggests, the potential benefit of this from the public interest group's perspective is that it would bring some coherence, some predictability to this whole process rather than the ad hocery which prevails now. It would set forth rules, regulations that every agency must follow in identifying, marking, safeguarding, and protecting such information. And I still think there's a value to that worth pursuing. It's also essential to achieving the other to some extent, contradictory objective of this whole program, which was to encourage greater sharing of such information with state and local governments in the wake of 9/11 and all the reports of the failure to share critical information with other federal agencies as well as state and local agencies. And the theory, which I think is a valid one, was that one great inhibitor for agencies sharing such information was that they were fearful that it would not be handled properly by whomever they shared it with. Well, if you have, again, government-wide guidance that is meant to bind everybody to certain rules, then you should have a greater confidence that it can be shared with people who, with whom it ought to be shared, and will be handled properly.
So in some bill, I guess it must be acknowledged that there has not been a breach of the 2002 commitment to consult because there has not yet been something issued. If not anything has been breached, it's been the promise of issuance.
May I?
Please. This is someone who is not
long. Dragged you into the briar patch.
That's right. Not long out of working for DHS in this very area. So might have some current information to bring to bear, too.
Well, I'll avoid the current information, but on the point of consultation, it was something that career officials fought strongly for. And a compromise, which I believe Bill is familiar with, took place in that consultation committees under the DNI were created.
DNI, another acronym.
Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Yes.
But that's a FLA. The consultation included identified state and local law enforcement, corporate officials. It did not, to the best of my knowledge, include any public interest groups. And since I conducted them, I'm pretty sure that they didn't.
This is the consultation that actually occurred.
The consultation with it, we fought for it as being required, and the compromise solution was that in order for there not to be a, dare I use another acronym, an advisory, federal advisory committee, BACA problem, it was done as a formal consultation with identified representatives of groups, but it did not include OMB Watch, for example.
Or any other public interest.
Let me suggest, if I may, speaking solely for myself and not for the National Security Council or the administration or anyone else, I would think that one legitimate role of public interest groups like OMB Watch should be to insist that such meaningful consultation take place before the formal proclamation of a policy like this, which will obviously affect the public.
The problem, I think, goes back to the lack of strategy, the lack of vision as moving forward in this area. To consider that aspect, to consider the public aspect, it has been approached from a purely administrative process so far. I mean, I will acknowledge that there still could be an official rulemaking process or something along those lines where there's a proposed policy under which formal comments could be submitted. Having participated in many rulemaking processes, I can say the ability to make changes to a policy at that stage is limited. And it would show much greater commitment from the government to incorporate these perspectives earlier on in the process as the policy foundations are being laid.
Does that mean if we add all of that up right now, that organizations such as OMB Watch and the Sunshine Government Initiative, such as Rick's organization and others who care about this,
ought to be communicating somehow to the appropriate places in the government to make sure that something is not promulgated.
And we have tried. I mean, we have tried. We've asked for meetings and inquired as to the status and when the opportunity will arise to engage. And again, we feel frozen out. We feel that, you know, that things are moving along, but there's nothing to share with us at that stage.
Needless to say, I won't surprise you, but I would reiterate a truism that silence is interpreted as consent.
I hate to interject myself.
Yes, Rick.
I'm stunned that this conversation is happening because, I mean, I think Sean is being incredibly reasonable. As the person who coordinated the letter in 2003 asking for a role, that was, we had over 50 organizations, public interest groups, you had news media groups. Everybody saw, who signed that letter, saw this as an incredible effort that was going to be complex and difficult, but it was going to have enormous impact on the functioning of journalism, the functioning of public interest work, and there's been no consultation. And this is 4+ years later.
And I'm thinking,
well, that's, so that's not my original comment.
There's also been no policy yet.
Well, I don't know if that's good or bad. I wanted to ask, actually, if that, maybe at Q&A, I really wanted to step back and ask, when I read the 2003, I think it was directive.
Executive order, excuse me.
The question that was in a number of our heads was, okay, you've got this new shizzy, which deals with unclassified information. How is this not the Freedom of Information Act exemptions? And are you trying to build something that talks to agencies about, okay, once information you've actually determined is exempt from public disclosure, here's how high the walls have to be given the kind of information? Or are you trying to do it in exemptions plus? I mean, this is a real fundamental question that I think a lot of us
have. Well, I mean, I think every version of this guidance, including the current version, so far as I'm aware of it, makes it explicitly crystal clear that the guidance is does not supersede the requirements of FOIA. That identifying and marking something as, in this current case, controlled unclassified information does not, underline not, in and of itself make that information exempt from disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act.
Any more than classifying it would. We're still going to review the information even if it is classified, and we have new ways of protecting post-9/11 type information as being actually classified under the amendment to the executive order. But even if it is classified, we're still going to review the document under the Freedom of Information Act.
And exercise fresh judgment at that time.
And practice reasonable segregation.
As Judge Lamberth was speaking about it at lunch, yes. I want to pose one question to all three of you, especially, well, I think I know Bill's answer already, because we worked so closely on this over the years. But Bill, you mentioned earlier that there was a breathtakingly broad scope to that enterprise that began going back to in 2003. Do you think that the fact that there still has not been anything issued by the government has still failed to wrap its arms around this, has anything to do with that breathtakingly broad scope, as opposed to, frankly, what you and I started working on, Shizzy, which was far narrower, right after 9/11?
Well, I honestly don't know why the last concentrated effort to produce this policy, which was directed by the PM, the program manager, who was established under the Information Reform Terrorism Prevention Act, and that process went on for, 2 years?
Yeah. We why have that, the why that, leaders of it in the audience.
Why that process has not yet produced a final product, I really don't know why.
I think what added to the confusion is what started with an effort
which was an attempt at looking at potentially protecting post 9/11 type information, got melded with a separate issue of these 110, however many separate designations. And that led to an exponential growth of the issue, which makes it that much more difficult to address.
That's a very valid point.
Yeah, yes. Very good summary. Sean, do you see it that way as well? And then we'll get to questions over here as well.
I definitely think that the broadness of the scope is both unavoidable, but also a major problem in terms of dealing with the issue in a timely fashion. We have gotten ourselves weighed down by a myriad of these new categories. I also think it's a problem, even considering the executive order. I think it's a problem of political will. I think when you try and tackle something like this, some sort of entrenched bureaucracy, this kind of calcification that occurs of throughout the agencies, the only way you're really going to make progress on this, and especially progress with the people implementing and the educational process that we were talking about, is to have an incredible amount of political will behind that effort to say, this is an important thing to be done. It's going to be done on time. When I say it's going to be done in a year, it's going to be done in a year. And to make it clear from the top down that this is the expectation. I think back to under President Clinton, this effort, the privacy information, personally identifiable information, was brought up, and the Clinton effort on privacy of information. There was a lot of presidential backing behind the privacy czar that Clinton instituted. And agencies responded to that. There was no law or anything like that was necessarily just passed, but it was a lot of presidential backing, and there was a lot of will pushed behind that. And we just have not seen that same kind of fire lit under this issue from the administration.
Let me just note, if I may, Dan, in terms of the breadth of what we're talking about, as Will mentioned, which has morphed into an effort to provide guidance for controlling all different kinds of sensitive but unclassified information, regardless of whether it has anything to do with terrorism. The current definition of CUI in the current draft of the guidance says that CUI means unclassified information that does not meet the standards for national security classification under Executive Order 12958 as amended, but is pertinent to the national interest of the United States or to the important interest of entities outside the U.S. federal government, and under law or policy requires protection from unauthorized disclosure, special handling safeguards, or prescribed limits on exchange or dissemination. Then goes on to say, I don't know what you would exclude from that, frankly. Information shall be designated as controlled unclassified information, number one, if a statute so requires or authorizes, fair enough, or, number two, if the head of the originating agency or department in implementing lawfully issued regulations, directives, or other specific guidance to the agency determines that the information is CUI.
Or. That word was or there, right?
Yes, or.
Yes.
Wow. Or whatever the head of the agency decides it is.
And, I mean, I think that's the concern. It, when we talk about this scope and we talk about unclassified information, classified information is overused, very greatly overused. And that's a tougher hurdle to get over than this controlled, unclassified information is going to be given. And I think the concern is, without a much clearer definition and restriction of scope, that this, even though it'll be simpler in that there'll be one identity and there'll be policies and procedures and regulations, which, again, will be an administrative improvement, will still be this behemoth of information that will wind up being restricted and will have made the problem acronym free, so to speak, but the problem will still be there.
We have a member of the CGS Advisory Board, Scott Armstrong, there, who probably has quite a reaction to what he's heard thus far as well. Scott never disappoints in that regard.
I'm glad I now can just call myself a member of the CGS Advisory Board and I leave everything else out. One small set of facts and then two related questions. At the time that the after the SISI legislation came down and the question was information sharing and how it would occur, and the Department of Homeland Security published its first non-disclosure agreement that began to ball some of this up, Jeff Smith, former general counsel of the CIA, and I raised some questions. And we had a conversation with the and that's my first question, is what the evolution of the program manager or person in charge has been. But it was the person who was then in charge at OMB. And he promised us a consultation for both the news media and for the public interest openness groups prior to the circulation of any redraft, but after he had had an opportunity to do a redraft. But, and remember, our concerns largely were non-disclosure agreements proliferating not only in the federal government but across other governments, and the nightmare that that would create. And if you may recall that particular one, which is the most absurd document I've ever read, anyone had stronger sanctions against people for disclosing SBU information than exist for most compartments of highly sensitive classified information. It was a bizarre document, to say the least. But that person's head rolled relatively quickly after that. We then talked to his successor. I tried to look up the names. If you mentioned to him, I'd probably remember him. I hope you'll give us this evolution.
Ted McNamara, perhaps?
That was
Ambassador
one,
McNamara.
Yeah, in the sequence. And then that person indicated that we should, I think it was indicated by the director that the action was moving to DHS on some of this, and that and then Bill Leonard told us that the non-disclosure agreement had been withdrawn. It was no longer operative. And so we backed off a little bit. But I recently, not that long ago, talked to Secretary Chertoff, who said, oh, we'll give you a call right away. I'm still waiting, although I have to admit I haven't followed up nor have I listened all that carefully for my phone to ring. My questions, though, are the sequence of control of where does the action lie, number one, and number two, what is the non-disclosure agreement and what's the state of play with that, not only in terms of federal employees, whether there'll be one uniform non-disclosure agreement, and whether or not that would also be applied to state, local, tribal governments, and to first responders who are not part of any government. Those two questions and any response that we can get to what happened along the way.
That's a tough one.
Well, I'm not sure I know what you mean by non-disclosure agreement, but as far as I know, the policy for controlled unclassified information does not anticipate any sort of non-disclosure agreement comparable to the clearance process for access to classified information. The effort to enforce non-disclosure, as it were, for information identified as controlled unclassified information would simply depend upon government officials, federal government officials, obeying mandatory guidance. And as for state and local officials who would have access to such information, there is an assumption that they will abide by the guidance that is prescribed for federal government employees as well. Because if they don't abide by it, they won't get access to any more information.
And so there'll be no formal non-disclosure agreement with criminal penalties or civil penalties?
No. In terms of the evolution,
not aware, I mean,
just
of
one bit of historical footnote, which Dan, again, is well aware of. When this issue first arose in the month following 9/11, the first instinct among many officials at the White House for dealing with this problem. We've got all this information out there that's not classified but is sensitive, and we want to make sure that it's shared with state and local responders. What do we do? The first instinct was, well, let's just classify it all. Make classified, and then we can control it. Well, I thought that was a horrible idea, and so did most people in the security classification community throughout government. I pointed out that the security classification system is full of onerous requirements, which in fact are intended to discourage the sharing of the information. And if one of your principal goals is to encourage sharing, the last thing in the world you want to do is classify it. Not to mention the incredible expense, including, for example, the requirement, presumably that would have been a requirement, to award security clearances to tens of thousands of state and local officials who'd have access to this information. So that issue was fortunately
a collateral question. Maybe for someone in the audience is what someone at DHS was smoking when they came up with the non-disclosure agreement they did, because it must have been a one big doobie by the time they were done.
Okay, well, the doobie became a don't be very quickly, I think. But question over here.
I was going to say, first of all, I couldn't agree more. I do want to note that the proposed rule that Scott was talking about was the last document not signed by departing Secretary Ridge. And much of this has been personality driven within at least the Department of Homeland Security over the years. But I wanted to make one point in reemphasizing what Bill was suggesting. Dan, in his introduction, mentioned how many different kinds of markings there were. What he didn't say was that the interagency working group identified 311 underlying statutory authorities enacted by Congress, which have fed over the years, including the creation in the Homeland Security Act of the Sensitive Homeland Security and PCII and SSI, that have contributed to this. And while it is a problem in the executive branch, it is a problem that has been fueled substantially by the Congress. And the breadth of having to deal with not just policy guidelines and notice and comment rules, but 311 underlying statutes means that the overbreadth of the reach of CUI, of which I'm very proud of the recommendations that finally left the Attorney General and the Secretary of DHS, was just stunningly large. The scope, probably necessary, but you can't mandate that the Congress repeal laws.
Well, speaking of Congress, this is a segue, I suppose, to one other factual point that I wanted to throw in before we concluded with questions, and that is we do have a bill introduced by Congresswoman Chairwoman Jane Harman that I believe it was introduced about the second or third week of December that would address secrecy in general, but as part of its provisions would explicitly address this particular area and provide for the harmonization and the reduction of the proliferation. Yes. See, that's why Bill is here to point them out as well. Provide for the harmonization and the reduction of the proliferation by statutory mandate, basically Congress grabbing onto this. Mm-hmm. And it may well be that if 2008 comes and goes without this process that began in 2003 with a presidential directive in December of 2005 and still nothing being issued, it may be that Congress will step in and fill the void.
I'd like to note, Dan, that the top first recommendation of the initial and on-time interagency working group was a moratorium on future legislation in this area until the recommendations could be issued in final form.
But can you blame Congress for jumping into it.
Three years
later, exactly right. How does that strike you, Sean? Does OMB Watch support that?
I would certainly support Congress getting involved. I can't say whether I'd support Congress's solution without having seen it.
My God, you sound like the Attorney General testifying in an oversight hearing. You can't endorse the legislation until you've read it. Very good. Okay.
But, I mean, I do think that there's probably a role for Congress to play here to really create the kind of requirements and momentum that we need, and also to split this sort of Gordian knot that we've got of, you know, so many different statutes, so many different new categories. So,
would it surprise you if, given this history, that it's taken so long after promises in 2002, 2003, 2005, if Congress did jump into the void and grappled with it where the executive branch has failed to do so? It failed to complete the process, I should say.
It would surprise me.
Okay.
It wouldn't surprise me if certain leaders in Congress tried to move forward with legislation, proposed legislation, even potentially pretty good legislation, but it is such a messy issue that I would be surprised if Congress wound up having the fortitude to move forward and really tackle this issue when they could be getting into the same briar patch that the executive is now stuck in. And right now, to some extent, they can beg off and say it is not, even though it is in part their creation. They can beg off and say this is the executive's problem. We want them to solve it, but if they try and solve it and they make it worse, which is a certain possibility, then it gets laid at their feet.
So one should not be so sanguine about the possibility of a legislative solution to such an intractable problem. Yes. Question over here, sir. Or
was that first?
No, I think you were up here first, John.
Okay. Patrice is usually right about such things. So.
I'll take her word on it.
Yes.
I work with a public advocacy group, a coalition on political assassinations. Our focus has been on primarily historical records, but I've also done some work around 9/11 Commission records. These are records that are segregated and locked up by congressional order, for the most part, or by executive order, like the Warren Commission volumes. At first, they weren't going to release anything. Hale Boggs said it might be a little fishy if they didn't, and Dulles said, go ahead and release some of it. Nobody will read it anyway, and so we got 8,000 pages. But the rest was locked up for 75 years. Then that was eventually reversed by a House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they locked stuff up for 50 years. That was reversed by the JFK Assassination Records Act, at least for the JFK records. The Martin Luther King records are still locked up there. And then we have a 9/11 commission that locked files up until 2009, which is a remarkably short period, 4.5 years, although it's still within the Bush administration, so I don't know if it can be reversed.
Be careful what you say. The general counsel of the 9/11 commission is standing in the doorway right there.
He probably knows who I am.
Probably knows who you are. That's Professor Dan Marcus on the
and
U Law School.
What I'll say is just the case that the 9/11 Commission report was released without any of the investigative records, for the most part, being released. There were three monographs, as they called them, from the investigative teams, but many of the interviews, classified and unclassified documents, were locked up under this order. And I understand that the National Security Archive did try FOIA on the agency-originated documents, and all of them failed. But this creates a kind of a weird situation where at least you can get an agency review under the law, a mandatory review of a classified document, but if an unclassified document is locked up, it's even deeper now than the classified ones. And so, I mean, we have some things that are sort of being classified by fiat as well as by these rules within the executive agencies themselves. And I don't know. I mean, to me, we've sort of tried to go around FOIA. We got a few thousand, maybe 10,000 pages with FOIA from 64 to 94 in the JFK assassination. We've got over 6.5 million from the Records Act model, 8.5 million pages released by the Nazi War Crimes Records Act. And we view FOIA, I mean, it's good to correct it, but we view it as plugging holes in a rusty bucket with which you're trying to drain a spring-fed lake.
Okay, we'll just have to accept that comment let it stand.
I have a question.
Interest of time, just we have one more.
Sure.
Concluding question for Patrice, because we're going to try to move to the next panel
right
by about 3:20 if we possibly can.
One click clarifying comment and then a question for Bill and Will. The clarifying comment is we were told by the program office of the information sharing environment that even though there might be 311 underlying statutes, that 81% of the CUI that they reviewed were made up by the agencies. They were what they call policy. They had no statutory basis at all. The question, though, for Will and Bill is the... The Public Interest Declassification Board has expressed some concern about dealing with CUI in documents that come to them for declassification review 25 years on. And they were suggesting linking decontrol and public release of CUI-designated information, linking it to the declassification process. In remarks this morning, I told them I thought that was inappropriate. This stuff is not classified. Patrice, it may have a much shorter life. But what is your reaction to that?
Patrice, just for the benefit of everyone in the audience, they may not know that this morning was the meeting of
right.
the public...
Public Interest Declassification Board.
The PIDB.
Right.
And we're speaking about something that happened just this morning.
Just this morning, right.
Okay.
Yes, right.
I think you gave them the right advice.
Good.
I think it brings up, and it gets back to something this gentleman said, you're obviously trying the MDR route, Mandatory Declassification Review route, to try to get us some documents, which, as you said, applies only to classified right. dockets, not to unclassified documents. And that's sort of a version of what you're
right.
talking about, Patrice.
Right.
It does bring up there are different programs for different types of documents.
But there is no program for CUI.
There is no program for CUI. And should there be? I think yes, because of the interest that has been brought about
right.
through this obvious effort and others.
Well, I'm not so sure that it would be wise to have something comparable to the procedures that exist for...
No, but now there are no procedures.
No. Well, there's the Freedom of Information Act.
And there's a security review program.
Is there?
We cannot count the MDR program because it only addresses classified
information. Well, and on FOIA, what I have heard anecdotally, and I know you want to wrap this up, is that every time people request something, they get rebuffed and told that it's SBU, it's FUOU, it's whatever, and you can't have it. End of story.
That's not the basis for withholding anything under the FOIA.
Well,
exactly.
Regardless.
Well, but I mean, I will say though, I mean, with the broad acknowledgement that there's information being overclassified, the frequency with which, or the lack of frequency with which any information that is either classified or stamped with one of these controlled unclassified information, the lack of frequency with which any of that information ever comes out through FOIA seems to indicate that the FOIA review is not finding out that they were mischaracterized or misstamped. Everyone acknowledges that it's being overused, and yet FOIA doesn't get any of the information out, or very, very little of it. And so I would say that the tendency, and maybe this goes back to the education process you're talking about, but right now the tendency is still to withhold.
Well, it sounds as if we've focused on a problem here that is at worst intractable and at best very, very difficult to deal with, so much so that it's going to be taking quite some time yet to come. But at least with this sort of analysis and certainly with the expertise that, as you can see, we have in this audience, we've been able to make a little bit of progress on focusing on the issues. And I thank everyone for your kind attention. Thank the panel members here for your